Well.
You don't know the history of me once not working.
10? I think it's a new file. It's the 10th file in this folder. Meanwhile, we're on page 73. I am Gimel Aleph, 73A. And we are holding, as they say, by a Mishnah there, which we're going to review. My mahalach today, my pathway for us in terms of the learning, is we're going to go over the Mishnah. We're going to look at some of the argumentation within the sugya, which is basically representative of the next several pages, as I had mentioned at the end of last class. And then I'm going to launch us a little bit into a deeper discussion of one of the verses that we're going to encounter that's used as a proof text. Because sometimes it's really worth understanding the Gemara's kind of hanging its hat on an individual verse and what ultimately we can glean in a deeper way even from the verse and see kind of where that verse has gone within the halachic literature and even in the modern literature. We're going to show you the difference between, say, the way an Eitz Chaim Chumash from the Rabbinical Assembly, United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism, ultimately makes a comment on the verse we're going to look at versus, say, the art scroll Chumash, the stone Chumash, and what exists in there. So many differences to look at tonight vis-a-vis this one verse. But before that, turning ourselves to the Mishnah again on 73A1. Okay? 73A1. So Matnitin, if you're in the Gemara, we learned in our Mishnah. Ve'elu hena shemati linotan benafshan. These are those whom we save from sinning, right? At the cost of their lives. Now, Rashi says, ve'elu matzilinotan. These are those that we save. Who are we talking about at that point? Min ha'avera. Since Rashi says, min ha'avera, we are saving them from transgressing, we're obviously talking about those who are in sin's way. We're not talking about necessarily those who are being pursued. We're talking about those who are about to commit some kind of transgression. Binafshan, Rashi says, first wide line, second entry. Nitnu leharag lechol adam kedei lahatzilan mina avera umikra nafke. It's permissible to actually save somebody from transgressing this major sin by killing them. The basic point. And this is one perspective that is presented by Rashi thus far. We're going to see that there's a language issue because the question is going to come, well, who are we really saving by actually killing this person? So for here, though, we're at least going with Rashi's sivara, Rashi's thought, that we're saving the transgressor. Harodefa char chavero lahargo, one who pursues his fellow to kill him, in other words, pays with his life. The achar hazachar, and the one who's running after a male to sodomize, pays with his life. Talked last time about the notion of whether or not the act in and of itself is dealing with commissions of avodah zarah, worship of the stars, worship of idols, and or the rabbi saw such an act in and of itself, of course, as not being allowable by Torah, and thusly the rabbis had to legislate it in such a straightforward way in order to make their position known. Ve'achar ha-na'ara ha-me'orasa, and one who's going after a betrothed na'ara to violate her, meaning one who is just gone through erusin, which means who's engaged, versus one who's all the way wed. Because remember, in the ancient world, a na'ara, a young woman, promised to a groom, would first be contracted, if you will. The families would contract, tanaim would come, conditions, and then you'd have erusin, betrothal. Kiddushin, the actual second part of the wedding ceremony, which today is done right one after the other, was done sometime later. So she could be in that betrothal stage, which we call today, in some similar fashion, but not exactly the same legally, engagement. She's engaged. Now the Mishnah provides the next list of people who cannot be held accountable and pay with their lives. Aval harodef achar be'emah, but one pursues a beast for the purposes of sodomy. V'hamechalel tashabbat, and one is about to desecrate the Sabbath. V'oved avodat kochavim, or one's about to engage in idol worship. Ein masilin otan benashan, you have no permission to actually save those people from sinning at the cost of their lives. Now, what's interesting here is that one might think that the Shabbat breaker might fall into a different category, because that ends with the punishment of Karet, right? What we know in terms of Karet is that there are certain categories of mitzvot that end up in Karet. So what is Karet?
God's punishment.
It's what?
God's punishment.
God's punishment to the point of?
Future generations.
Future generations, according to some Torah way of looking. It's basically death. Spiritual and physical death. Right? It's death. It's just legacy of death. Being cut off entirely. Okay? Among those sins is Shabbat, or our Shabbat, Pesach, Brit Milah, the Bris, and Yom Kippur. That if one doesn't really do what's necessary. Now, what's interesting about Shabbat, just by way of the whole overarching conversation here, is that the rabbis limit, in a certain sense, the notion of karet for Shabbat. Because they say over there that in Masechet Shabbat, there's got to be two edim, two witnesses. And what do the witnesses have to do? What's now required by way of the legal system that we've defined for ourselves?
They need to witness you desecrating the Sabbath.
They need to what?
They need to witness you desecrating the Sabbath.
They need to witness it. They need to warn. They need to both be there witnessing, and they need to warn the person, and the person needs to say,
I hear you. And
but
I'm doing it anyway.
Wow.
So, in the sense that you have Shabbat here defined among the people who cannot pay with their lives, who are not, in terms of our allowances here, who are not allowed to be killed, saved from a transgression, you have a certain sense that the rabbis don't want to take anyone who's involved with Karet and just put him in the category of almost transgressing it, and therefore we kill him to save him. So might it apply to those other categories of sins punishable by Karet that we wouldn't say that we could ultimately take their lives in order to save them from such transgressions? Well, you see time and again that some of those other mitzvot, the rabbis were actually into making chances happen. How with Pesach? How is there a second chance with Pesach?
Two Seders.
So once you're out of Eretz Yisrael and you got two Seders, here's your second chance. I like that. That's a good second chance. Yeah, right. I mean, in a certain way, that is a second chance vis-a-vis getting a date right? There's Pesach Sheni as well, which is month later, these people come to Moses in last week's Parsha, and they say, Moses, we're Tameim, we're not ritually fit to offer this sacrifice. Can we please figure this out? So through the story of them approaching Moses, being ritually impure and not able to fulfill the Passover rite, Moses implements the system of Pesach Sheni, which is the 15th of the next month. They're able to bring their korban, their sacrifice. Talk about Brit Milah for a minute. Brit Milah, the father doesn't do it. We don't say run right out and kill the father. So this is on the father, the obligation. What do we say? I don't know if you've learned this part of Kiddushin in the past. It's a wonderful paradigm.
He needs to enable it. He doesn't need to do it.
What's that?
He needs to enable it.
He needs, well, even if he doesn't enable it, we say that ultimately the community is responsible.
So what, do they push him aside and take care of it?
They basically do. They basically, the Beit Din basically says, hey, take care of this business. And we'll see that, maybe we'll see that inside the Mishnah. Maybe that's a good part of the Gemara to learn. It's in Masechet Kiddushin. Wonderful Gemara. So, just talking about what we can notice as we go through the Mishnah and the kind of texture of the legal realities there. You know, why would it be, for a second though, think with me out loud. Why would it be that if someone's going to do to a beast one of the aveiro, one of the sexual transgressions, why does that stand so distinctly apart from the transgression up on top where someone's running after someone to sodomize them?
It's not another human.
Yeah.
But if I'm saving him from his transgressing, in both cases, I might say he's going to transgress by either doing X or Y.
It's different levels. Ben Adam Lamakom and Ben Adam Lechavero. So when it's Ben Adam Lamakom...
Translate your Hebrew, will you?
Ben Adam Lamakom is between one and God, basically, or the community at large. And Ben Adam Lechavero is between one and his friend, his buddy. So when you do sins against person, then it's death. When you do it between you and God or Lamakom, then it's just punishment by the Din.
So you're putting into the category of Makom, between you and God, the instance with the animal.
Right. Because it's Avodah Zarah. It's Avodah Zarah. It came from the pagan.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I would have to disagree because ritual transgression in public means witnessed transgression is a threat more to the community than to anything else. So the idea of cutting somebody off, whether it's Aaron or you kick them out. So it's perceived as a threat to the community. If somebody, I mean, it's not easy being Jewish. So if you if you transgress, you don't follow Shabbos, you don't keep Pesach or Yom Kippur, and there are no consequences, you could undermine the whole social agreement, the whole social contract. So
yeah. Over here, though, remember that this guy who is transgressing or desecrating the Sabbath is not killed. It doesn't have to give his life.
He's not killed. He's going to be eliminated.
Well, we do hold that right. We do hold that if you go by Torah law, he's definitely among those who ultimately will receive just punishment. No doubt about it. Let God, in essence, create the punishment for those people versus the human being who is standing there at the time to act like both jury and judge is the message in a certain sense if you take the top list versus the bottom. How society deals with it, ultimately, if there's some kind of court action that can be taken against people, even versus God's meting out the punishment, that's left to understanding from other Gemaras, other Mishnayot, but it's true that there's a communal element in basically all of these. So why some were able to have the guy who's about to transgress pay with his life versus the other is somewhat of interest, especially if we're reading with Rashi. My point in the question is this. Even before we get to some other language problems, Rashi said we're saving the person who's about to transgress by taking his life, right? So I might think that goes through with all of the instances here in terms of sin. But with the latter three, I now see, perhaps, it's not exactly only to save this guy from sin. If it's a betrothed na'ara, a young woman, if it's another man, if it's a man being pursued so that his life will be taken, that's one thing. If it's an animal, also a life, but in a different category. If it's Shabbat, not a live person. If it's Avodah Zarah, idol worship that is problematic to the community, but not exactly going to harm anyone this moment, I'm going to have a different category of law. So it's not about only the one doing it. It's about the aspect or that which is impacted by the action of the transgressor. So already from the Mishnah, I can see an internal debate. Do I save him because he's transgressing? Or do I save her, him, because these others don't have any victims per se, despite the fact that they affect and impact community? If it's not committed, right. But if it is committed,
yeah,
we have victims.
I thought you had to witness something in order to exact.
Well, remember we talked about how it's the witnessing of the pursuit that allows me to be jury and judge at that moment. That is a actual very, very big deal here, right? What are we really witnessing?
Yeah.
And how do we decide?
How do you know?
At what point can I really take this life? Laura, then Charlie.
Oh, I was going to say, is there an onus or burden on the girl, the young woman, I shouldn't say young, okay, the woman and the man and the beast to try to remove themselves from the situation of being impacted by the person who's motivated to harm them?
I think that there would absolutely be some onus inherently seen by the fact that the situation is not kam v'yaharog. He didn't just get up and kill him. It's
right.
The case of who wrote death.
Yeah.
Ahara. He's chasing after, meaning there's some
they're
give
to
the chase.
Right. So there is that difference.
I think there is.
Category.
I think there is as well, yeah.
But do you think that when you're further defining the pursuer spirit we were talking about last week, like you see two people pursuing each other, you don't necessarily want to just, you know, cop out your six shooter and shoot the second guy because you don't know what's happening.
Correct.
So you might want to find out, so you step in the middle. All right, so you broke up the fight. On the second set of things, well, if you leave out the stuff with the beast, which is far too bizarre for me, desecrating Shabbat, you at least, well, you messed up this Shabbat, but you have next Shabbat to straighten it out. Whereas once you, like, shoot someone, you don't have next weekend to fix that, right?
Right.
So it's two different things. One, it like, further defines the pursuer.
Right.
What the witness but
right.
So the others aren't reversible, except I guess if you're unbetrothed, you don't count. But what happens is that you
become, quote-unquote, really debased, disgusting in the eyes, not only your own eyes, but in the eyes of sometimes
if
the...
If you're unbetrothed and you're...
If you're violated.
Yeah, so that's like damning the victim. Like
it is.
Weird.
Yeah.
My
right, so non-reversible, back to your point.
I'm surprised that they didn't continue after Hara Nara Meureset if he raped a young woman, but if she was married already, they killed both of them. So that's some kind of, the minute she's married, then she didn't do any crime, she just was raped. And the community allowed to kill both of them, and that's interesting.
Only if they commit adultery as willing partners.
You can prove, you know.
Yeah,
nowadays,
I mean,
nowadays
this is a complicating. It's a complicating women's victim
right,
issue.
So.
But we're talking about someone who's forcibly attacked here, you know. So as not to create other possibilities.
But it's interesting that they put the limit on the
Meureset. Yeah. I hear you. So I just think it's interesting to see the sides here, what the rabbis are interested in. And are we really saving someone for his end, both in this world and the world to come? Or are we really trying to stand up and save victims? And I think the tension here, or the both-and-ness of this section of Gemara, is that we're really worried about both. So just interesting to keep in mind. But they're very practical, the rabbis, Chazal, and they're going to get into some nitty-gritty with, as I mentioned, the verse that's going to challenge us to respond, if necessary. Not only to these situations, but to others as well. So let's push into the Gemara now. A Braita provides the scriptural source for our Mishnah's ruling. So again, the Braita is one of those sources on the cutting room floor. It's not a Mishnah itself. It's from the age of Chazal, from the Tanaim, and it's around, most likely during that time, performed orally as a tradition, brought to the Beit Midrash along with the Mishnah as, quote-unquote, a coined set of understandings and teachings. Tanu Rabbanan, our rabbis taught this in a Braita. Minayin l'rodef achar chaveiro lahargo. From where do we know that if someone pursues his fellow to kill him? And of course, the from where do we know question is asking for a proof text. How are you going to prove this for me from the text? Shenitan lahatilo benafsho, that it's allowable to save him with his life. Talmud lomar, the text says, Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. You shall not stand by the blood of your friend, but rather you should save him. You shall not stand by the blood of your friend. Lo ta'amod, do not stand, al dam re'echa. What does the word al there mean? Well, here they translate it as by. Al dam re'echa, the blood of your friend. Sounds lovely in terms of its universalist nature, right?
Against.
Do not stand idly by.
You wanted to mean in contrast to that against. Are you suggesting a different alternative?
I'm not suggesting yet, but I am suggesting that we think about it.
Okay.
What might?
I thought you meant all. Not just standing by something, but ignoring something, which is, I don't know, maybe I'm...
Play it out.
Well, I was just thinking that if you stand against something, then you're turning your back. You're actively turning away from something as opposed to not...
Good.
Notice.
If I translate this as against, which I was going to suggest later, so thank you.
Okay, good.
Good. So then, I even take steps to not deal with it.
Yeah.
I justify my way out of it.
Yeah.
So, it might even make sense in context. I'm just going to tell you right now, even though we're going to look at papers later. Don't go around tail-bearing among your people, is the first part of the verse. And don't stand against the blood of your brother. And don't really deal with it. Why? Because if you go out now yapping and trying to make it right, what's going to happen, according to laws of Lashon Hara, of tail-bearing? You're going to create what's called Avak Lashon Hara, the dust of tail-bearing and mongering. Avak Lashon Hara. And just because I go up to someone and say, you know, I really think she's quite a special person, and you're going to say, oh, you want to know how special? That's avak lashon hara. So it might just be, don't go tail-bearing. And by the way, ignore that blood-shedding that so-and-so did when they spoke lashon hara. Could be one way to really push that translation when it comes to Torah. I just offer that because, again, the verse is going to come up a little later down the line in the Gemara itself. Before we stop and really look at it, I want to learn some more Gemara. The Gemara objects. V'ha'lahachi hudata. But you brought that verse. This is the parlance of the Gemara, it's the hermeneutics of the Gemara, it's the fun of the word game, the verse game that they play. According, again, Professor Heinemann says, the holiest word games ever played on earth. Rabbis trying to attach words from the Torah to learning and to rules that they create in the Jewish legal system. But I need that verse for something else. I need it for what was taught in a brayta. From where do we know that if one sees his fellow drowning in a river? Oh, haya gorarato. Or if he sees a wild beast ravaging a fellow. Oh, listim ba'in alav. Or bandits coming to attack him. Shehu chayav lahatilo. That he's obligated to save him. Talmud Lomar, Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. The verse says in Leviticus, do not stand idly by the blood of your fellow. And if you're going to use this verse to understand that brayta and learn those three possibilities of saving somebody, you can't tell me that up above in the Mishnah, you're allowed to use the same proof text. Ein hachinami. Indeed it's so. This verse does not teach that a pursuer may be killed. In this case, the word ein is not like not. It's like ein hachinami. So say it isn't so. It's like recognizing. So it's not so. What do I do? Ve'elan nitama hatiloban nafsho minalan. But then from where do we derive that a fellow should be saved at the cost of the pursuer's life? If we're not going to bring it from that verse. Atya v'kal v'chomer. Minara me'orata. Let's bring it from a kal v'chomer. Which is what? Translated here as? A fortiori. So you want to, someone in legal parlance, can you have a better?
All the more so.
An all the more so argument. Mm-hmm. Right? Is that, is there such a thing, by the way, in the American legal system?
Absolutely. All the time.
Can you think of an example?
Can you say it at the Supreme Court?
Yeah, sure. What does it say? What does it mean? What does it mean? What you're saying is exactly what it is here. If you're going to do X in this situation, of course you're going to do X in this other situation because the other situation is an even worse situation or an even better situation or a stronger situation. You go from the weaker to the stronger. Fortiori, strength.
Right, fortiori, strength. The strength of one position over another. So,
kind of like moreover.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like that,
yeah.
Exactly. Kal v'chomer is exactly like that. If my parents don't already let me see PG-13 movies, kal v'chomer, they're not going to let me into an R-rated film. Right? When I ask kids in Talmud class to give me examples that really pertain to their lives,
that's
what they come up with.
It
is right on.
Yeah.
Now, then I confuse them. If I'm not allowed to use my cell phone during a Broadway play, all the more so I shouldn't be able to use it in school. What? Wait a minute. Does that really hold? Should see the Talmud that's created. Right? Get a little limber here with me. What's a great a fortiori argument that doesn't necessarily hold? It's not so easy to come up with on your feet. I'll talk a little. Mm-hmm. If you want to do the one that does hold, I'll take it.
It doesn't hold because doesn't hold, or is it just a misapplication of the rule?
No, it doesn't hold because there's like not real strength in that. There's real strength in that for me because what's my assumption about school?
There's more
important than Broadway.
What's theirs?
Broadway. Nothing.
That nothing's as sacred as my paying for a ticket and being an audience member, spending $120 for this 2.5-hour performance. The lights are off. It's dark. I can't possibly make an interruption. But over here?
But nothing's as sacred as the cell phone and using it.
but they'll still accept it. Some. So what I'm saying is that sometimes these arguments really rest on the assumptions and the prior understandings with which one brings to the table, with which one argues when one brings to the table such an argument in a legal matter.
You need to have a common logic.
Or at least you need to be able to understand that somebody might challenge you. Somebody might see in your kal v'chomer no real reason to say that one really is stronger than the other. This happens all the time in Gemara. The other question in Gemara that happens with this kind of argumentation is, wait a minute, where did you get the first assumption? You're now telling me kal v'chomer, you got to save this person because you're supposed to save that person. But how did you learn that you're supposed to save that person? Okay? So these are the kind of ways that Talmudic logic comes to play. And the questions of the interlocutors comes to make discussion in the Talmud. Okay? We'll push forward if someone comes up with a good one over time. I welcome any kal v'chomer. Okay, ve'ela nitan lahatzi lo b'nafsho min alon. But when, for then, do we derive that the fellow should be saved at the cost of the pursuer's life before already throwing out the verse that you can't stand idly by the blood of your brother? It comes through a kal v'chomer, the aforeshary argument, minara me'orsa. So from the law of the betrothed nara. Manara hamnarasa shelo baila lefogma. If concerning a betrothed nara, whose pursuer comes only to blemish her. Amra Torah nitan lahatzilo b'nafsho. The Torah states that she should be saved at the cost of the pursuer's life. Roide fachar chaveru l'hargo. Alachat kama v'kama. The one pursuing a friend to actually murder him, even the more so, we should save him by taking the life of the one pursuing him. Does it hold? If he only comes to do the violent crime and she becomes either ineligible or not, depending on what she says, what she didn't say, whether there's a whole outcome of this, let's leave that aside for a second with what happens to her. But he comes lefogma, according to the Gemara. So what does that really mean? To blemish her, says down below, that would demean and humiliate her. Of course it would. If he's only coming to demean her and humiliate her, then the one chasing a friend to kill him, surely we're going to save him at the cost of the pursuer's life. Makes sense. Makes sense. Yeah, I mean, there's a certain notion. There is vengeance killing. There is vengeance killing.
So therefore, her life is at risk also.
Right. And if she would be married, they'd kill her immediately.
Well, that's a separate story. Let's just stay with what.
Only in Pakistan.
Well, today, but we're talking about.
Yeah, but this is
right,
the what
he's
dealt
with. In our tradition, we had it also then.
Yeah. I mean, and the rabbis here were looking to legislate these things in a way that would not necessarily lead immediately to those kinds of actions. But we had ways of legislating and adjudicating that would take care of this kind of an issue. Rashi here doesn't say that she is ultimately now entirely ruled out of the Erusin.
But
somewhat of an open door, if you will, to have a discussion here about just what this really does to her. Rashi's comment is that she's demeaned, and she is obviously put into great terror, sees her as a victim, victimizes her. So he's basically saying she is only victimized, only. She's victimized, but this one who's looking to kill a person, come on. So then the Gemara turns and says, "V'chi onshin min hadin." But can we derive a punishment? In other words, such a punishment to be judge, jury, and executioner on a logical inference? So in this case, the question is, can you really use a kal v'chomer as a source for killing a pursuer? And if you look, for a kal v'chomer is based upon human reason, which is inherently fallible, says down on footnote 10. Therefore, we may not rely upon it to impose capital or even corporal punishment, no matter how correct the argument seems. And that's, in essence, the position of many of the Rishonim. It's very difficult to see that this kind of logic would lead us to make a capital case decision.
Yeah, but the capital case decision is written in the Torah.
Right, but they're understanding the Torah. Their project is to understand the Torah and to pull parts of verses out and to rest on verses and to make sure they know where the proof is once it's going to be acted upon. That's what the rabbinic project is. They don't just go with Peshat. They're not satisfied with that. Having rejected two possible sources for the Mishnah's law, the Gemara suggests another. Devei Rebbe Tana at the Braita in the Academy of Rebbe taught as follows. Now, what's interesting there is that we're talking about a Braita in the Academy of Rebbe. Sometimes, right, it's just nice to note the historical realities. So it's not that Rebbe had a Mishnah that he created and edited and then said, by the way, we're not going to study the other material. They kept it alive. This is in the Beit Midrash of Rebbe, where we might only think that since this is the academy of this great scholar, the only books we read are these. This is now inclusive of all the other texts that didn't necessarily make their way into the Mishnah per se, because we have a Braita. And the Braita says, Hakeshahu. It's derived from a scriptural analogy. Yeah. Excuse me. I happen to just overhear the discussion. Good discussion. Rebbe is Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, is Rabbi Judah the Prince, who edited the Mishnah in the year 200, or so we say. And the point that I was making was all about how I think it's quite remarkable, or it's at least notable, that since Rebbe is the editor of one book or another, that he would still include the study of sources outside of his Mishnah once he coined them. Because a Braita, when the word is used in the Gemara, is a text that's outside of the Mishnah corpus, right? So that he brought it forward and studied it, and now it's brought in, and it's offered that it was a hekeshahu. It's derived from a scriptural analogy. A hekesh is based on a tradition, according to Rashi. Shehu kash rotzeach lenara hamirotzah v'chol hekesh u'gzereshava hamifureshet hareihu kamifuresh b'mikra. Rashi says, you thought you couldn't learn from the a fortiori argument because it was just a matter of human logical production. Now you tell me that there's a braita in Rabbi Judah the Prince's Beit Midrash that called for learning the source of this from what's called a hekesh, which is a scriptural analogy. If the language over here in one case in the Torah is similar to the language over here in another case, I can read the both of them and learn out a rule that is applicable to A, even where the rule isn't stated explicitly there, because it is explicitly stated over here in B. The language being parallel, I can take the rule from B and apply it to A. Rashi adds, uniquely though, he says, and don't worry that it sounds like I'm asking you to rely on human logic, because everywhere that there's a scriptural analogy called a hekesh, and everywhere that there's a scriptural analogy called a gezeirah shava, it is already a scriptural reality. It's a mifureshet. Mifu Rashba Mikra. It's clear and explained and explicit in the Bible itself. That's our tradition. That one Kal Vachomer argument is not as, if you will, scripturally based as the Hekesh, the scriptural analogy, or the Gezeir Shalah. Which is why the Breita comes and potentially offers more of a proof to why we can take these people's lives. So we say, Ki kasher yakum ish el al re'ehu urtzacho nefesh. So it says, after teaching a betrothed na'ara, a young woman who is engaged, is not punished for committing adultery against her will. The verse states, for like a man who rises up against his fellow and murders him, so is this thing, the rape of the betrothed na'ara. V'chi ma lamadnu mirotzeach. Now, what do we learn from the laws of a murderer? Me'ata harei ze balu lamed. So now it seems as if this mention of a murderer came to teach something about a nara. Right? Because it comes right after the situation where she is attacked. V'nimtza lamed. But in fact, we find it came the subject of a different teaching. What's the different teaching about? The different case that it's coming to teach about, though, is our case of the one who's about to murder somebody. Makish rotzeach l'nara amerosa. That is, the verse compares the law of a murderer to the law of a betrothed nara. Ma nara hamerosa nitan l'hatzila b'nafsho. Just as a betrothed nara should be saved from rape at the cost of her assailant's life. So too, the case of a murderer, the potential victim should be saved from death at the cost of the pursuer's life. So I see in Scripture that this comes right next to this. The Scripture brought the two halves of the verse together to compare the like the one going to murder his friend to this case, the one about to attack and raped the betrothed woman. Since he can rise up and kill the one about to do that to the betrothed woman, I obviously can do the same to the one about to kill his friend, who is the rodef can be killed. The one chasing after his friend can be killed. Okay? So the positioning of the verse. The above breita, as they say here, they've done a nice job, I think, here. The above braita assumes that the assailant of a betrothed nara may be killed to save her from rape. There's the, again, sometimes the assumption. Where do we actually get the notion that anyone doing that, in essence, at any point, could be killed? Should it be deemed? Back to our problem we noticed before, Carol, that there is someone deeming here that I, in this act of these people, I deem that this person is going to attack this woman and I can rise up and kill him because of what he's about to commit, the crime he's about to commit. That's a lot of responsibility on the shoulders of individual people. But the assumption of the Gemara is that person, if we really deem that that's about to happen, that can lead to my saving her with his life. V'nara me'orasa gufa minala. And how do we really know the fact that she can indeed be saved by his death, by making him pay with his life, the one who's pursuing her, pursuing this violent crime? Ki detanya devei Rabbi Yishmael, as it's taught in the Academy of Rabbi Yishmael, detanya devei Rabbi Yishmael, as it's stated there, v'ein moshialah. Scripture states, the Torah states, she had no rescuer. From that, I imagine, Hayesh Moshiela, that if there was someone who could have rescued her, Bechol Davar Sheyachol Hoshia, that with any method possible, he would have been able to save her. So if it says that there was no one to save her, we now see that if there was someone to save her, in any methodology possible, he could have saved her with the taking of the criminal's life. By any means possible. Now that's a jump that also is being made, but to the protection of this young woman. From there, we see that if she can be saved by taking his life, therefore the murderer who's chasing after his friend could also be killed, because by any means possible, we should save someone's life who's being pursued. That's where we've arrived. And according to Rashi, that is not simply human logic, that the Torah stated it so close to each other, makes it a very scripturally based argument.
It could still be human logic.
Just telling you what Rashi is presenting to us.
And what's supposed to happen to the person who commits, who kills the prospective perpetrator?
Well, in this case, it's allowable.
Nothing. It goes on.
So they,
yeah.
That reasoning is superior to a Kalmachomer because it is obviously written out. It's a scripture. It comes from scripture.
Right. There's a certain verse that seems to have these two parts. Because the rabbi saw in that obviously a scriptural parallelism or placement where one verse comes here and this part of it comes over there, they learned from the both.
To the same place.
It does come. So in the law, I mean, you have an expertise in this as well. In the law, is there sometimes where one argumentation methodology stands you in better stead? Yeah?
I mean, if it's statutory or if there's case law on the point, you use it. Because, you know, it's part of the, part of our... We use our tools, and if there's nothing on point, then you argue logic, and you try and squeeze your facts under the statute or into the case law that you've researched.
So in a certain way, that there's still the debate.
Sure.
Do I just kind of base myself in logic, or do I base myself in text, that is?
Or if you have the text, you use the text.
Uh-huh.
What are the two kinds of text, that one is above the other, and status?
Sure. Constitution
sure.
Trumps all.
Okay.
Then statutes.
Okay. And if you don't have that and you don't have the case law on your side, you bang on the table.
Shall tell you.
The judge trumps everything.
Right. I mean, ultimately, there's a human factor in all this, which is a piece of this. The next piece goes back to what they then said earlier. Right? Now I've learned my case about how I can take the life of someone about to commit any of these crimes, and so where does that leave me with my Leviticus verse? It's possible that I can let it stand in the teaching where it came before. That was for cases that were not in our Mishnah, but in a different set of cases, I can now use that verse to prove it. So the Gemara goes back, Gufa, let's get down to the essence of this now. Minayin l'ro'e et chaveiro shehu toveh b'nahar. Where do I know that if one sees his fellow drowning in a river, oh haya gorarato, or that a wild beast is going to ravage him, oh listin ba'in alav, or that bandits are coming to attack him, shehu chayav l'hatilo, that he's actually required to stand up and save him. Tamud lomar, lo tamud al dam re'echa. Scripture therefore teaches, you shall not stand idly by the blood of your friend. Good, right? Because we got rid of that need we had for this verse to teach our cases. Now we can go back, right? And it all seems to wrap up very nicely if that was the place that it ended. But it doesn't end there. Of course not. Because I got to challenge it again. I got to say, v'hamehacha nafka. But is it indeed from here that this law is derived? Mehatam nafka. It's actually derived from over there. The law is derived from a verse in Deuteronomy. Now, why did they actually quote you something from Deuteronomy? Probably because the law above was proven from Deuteronomy when it came to the betrothed young lady. They wanted to use the Deuteronomy text. I have a theory. It's a working theory. I'll let you know as we study Gemara, please God, for many years. My theory is given a statement like that, without hatam, meaning this particular verse, that they're just saying it's from over there, that, yeah, they might mean even the same area of the Torah, but maybe they have an argumentation going on here about how and when we use verses from Exodus, Shemot, and how and when we are going to look at Devarim, Deuteronomy, as verses for proof. So it's an interesting kind of...
What's your theory?
A question. My theory is that some parts of the Talmud might want to really use Deuteronomy in a way as a hat to hang. Though all of Torah is quite, you know, full of the holiness of Torah itself, and it's called Mikra, right? What's that?
A single
reading, a single unit.
Yeah.
There is some degree of looking to text of Torah by the rabbis to say we need to uplift a certain number of verses within each of these in order to make some law here so that people will get a sense of the holiness of each of the Chumashim. So I'm starting a look through. You know, it may be that it's actually not at all balanced. It may be that it's very balanced. There's one article that I'm searching for about proof texts in the Talmud itself, about where they're from. You know, there are certain books of the Tanakh we know were more the favorites of the rabbis within the Talmud. Shir HaShirim is quoted a lot. Jeremiah the prophet. Hosea is quoted here and there. So the notion here that they say over there, meaning, you know, come on, go back to Deuteronomy as opposed to bringing me that Leviticus verse that we were just using, don't stand idly by. Not anything proven, but I thought interesting that they wanted to push it out of that realm, because it wrapped up nicely in a package there. If they would have left it back to, okay, I learned about these cases in our Mishnah from Deuteronomy, and I learned about really jumping to the saving a friend from the Leviticus verse, all's done. The Braita, they go back into a verse that they read quite metaphorically. Watch what they do with this. Next verse. It's a little bit of a pushed read almost. They go into Deuteronomy. They say, and I'm on 73a3 now, Avedat gufo meinayim. The Torah clearly states that a lost object must be returned to its owner. Okay, well now we're in lost objects. But from where do we know that one must return a lost body? Meaning what? Meaning, someone's life is about to be lost. There's really no indication in the text itself that when we're talking about lost objects, we're talking about the loss of one's life. But the read here is that I already dealt with the returning of lost objects through some of the verses and some of the verbs. So now I'm talking about the lost object being
life.
And it says, Talmud Lomar, Vahashevoto lo. You shall surely return it to him. And in that, if this is the verse that teaches that one must save one's life, fellow's life, then why would the verse, do not stand by the blood, be teaching the same thing? In other words, I have this verse to teach that, therefore I don't need that verse from Leviticus again. Imehatan, if we derive the obligation from there, that verse, you shall return it to him. Hava minahane mele benafshe. I would have said that this obligation applies only when a person himself has the opportunity to save a fellow's life. Aval, mitrach, umegar, agore, emalo. But with regard to bothering to hire a rescuer, I would say that one is not required to do so. Kamash malan, therefore, the verse, you shall not stand by the blood of your brother, therefore informs us, what? That he's required even to hire someone to rescue the fellow. So wait a minute, here's what happened. I can make harmony with it all. As long as I learn from Deuteronomy that I'm required to save his life because he's about to lose it. Oh, I can then come back and understand what this verse, don't stand idly by the blood of your brother, is really doing. It's telling me I can't stop just by me. I got to hire someone to actually take care of that same end of saving my fellow. Don't stand idly by the blood of your brother, meaning get up. If you can't save him yourself and fulfill the verse in Deuteronomy by saving him yourself, go and hire someone. Does it say that?
Well, the two phrases, as you said, Mara says, imply two completely different things. In one case it says, save him if you can. In the other phrase it says, save him if you can, and if you can, you got to do whatever you can. Get somebody else to save him, hire a... So it doesn't say that one or the other source is the source of the... just as they either one could be the source, but if one is the source, it implies one thing. If the other is the source, it implies another.
Good. So we don't really have an entire resolution,
no.
Right? If we want to prove the, if we want to prove that in this case, the Brita, someone's drowning in a river. Wild beasts are going to ravage him. Third case. What? The three that came up. What's that?
The woman.
Listim. So here's what we're talking about right now. Talking about one who sees his friend drowning in a river, one who sees the wild beasts are going to ravage him, and third, bandits are going to come and overcome him. They were trying to prove it from don't stand idly by the blood of your brother. Some people wanted to see it from the same Deuteronomic reality that I proved my Mishnah from, because I used the Deuteronomy verse to prove the whole case with the betrothed woman and the one being chased. And if I used the Deuteronomy source to prove that part, that I have to save the drowning person, the one who's being ravaged by beasts, or the one whose bandits are going to come, the one where bandits are going to come, then I can use my Leviticus verse to say, and I even have to go hire somebody if I can't do it myself. Now, there's a nice Torah for supporting the rescue workers. Hatzalah, the fire and emergency services, the rescue squad. What is the whole notion of the one who's going to be ravaged by beasts? Picture the situation for a minute. Where is this guy?
In the desert.
What? He's in the forest, he's in the desert. He climbed over some fence. He's up a tree. So somehow, there's got to be some way to help him that I don't know about. My expertise is not dealing with getting animals out of here. I got to go find somebody. Go back to the other one. Drowning in a river. Why do I have to hire somebody? I don't know how to swim. I never learned.
Yeah, but your father has a mitzvah to teach you.
Your father might have a mitzvah to teach you. Yeah. Again, Masechet Kiddushin. But if I don't know how, I gotta go find somebody. And bandits are going to overcome him?
On the train.
No train? No train? You need help. You got bandits here. You need a posse of people. It's like a good old Western.
So you pick up your cell phone.
So ultimately, I get into a situation where all these verses are coming to teach me that I have responsibility to my fellow people. Even though the Mishnah started with the notion of severe, like these people are about to be killed or raped. And in this situation, there are major transgressions of idol worship, Shabbos being violated, all kinds of things, bestiality. I now am in a discussion where society could see these things a lot more often, let's say.
Why did I mention fire?
Because ultimately, I believe, and we'll see this a little bit, that there is the tension between how much you endanger your own life.
So that's the question why I'm asking.
So,
to what extent,
right, exactly,
can we force one to save the other?
I mean, that's part of the codific reality that actually I don't have here, but I'll explain. But I want to look, if you can take one and pass it along, I want to look at this verse, the kind of societal obligation that it spurs, the kind of way the verse has been looked at as a tool to now really say that you've got obligations to rescue and save your friends. If we go with the last thought of the Gemara, it's also to hire people and to have them on hand. And this is one of the places where in halakha, in Jewish law, they use this to say you better have a rescue team and you have to live in a community that has such a team, even though that's not one of the primary things that's in the official codes about the kind of community you have to live in. By the way, what's that? You have to have a mikveh. You have to have a school, you have to have a synagogue, you have to have a doctor, you have to have someone who will take care of the tzedakah. Okay, but the rescuing becomes very important because of this. I gave you a couple of different things. I want to look at them. They're of interest to us because of this verse. The first one is the translation of the stone chumash, the art scroll, the blue one. We have several copies up in the sanctuary. You shall not be a gossip monger among your people. Remember I mentioned that that's the first part of this verse where don't stand idly by appears. You shall not stand aside while your fellow's blood is shed. Okay? There's one translation. There's not a warfare kind of verb in the actual Hebrew. Al tamod, lo tamod al dam reyecha. Don't stand idly by the blood of your brother is more miluli, is more word for word. Where his blood will be shed sounds as though they're already thinking of this by way of the situation in our Mishnah, where the one is chasing another person to kill him, and then you rise up and you take care of business. The stone chumash is an interesting project. It's an art school chumash. What you have to know about the art school chumash is they're oftentimes translating with their knowledge of Gemara and their knowledge of Rashi, and they put the rabbinic read in, and they especially put oftentimes Rashi's read. I included the Hebrew down below. And you can see the asterisk. You shall not stand aside while your fellow's blood is shed. If someone's life is in danger, you must try to save him. Although one is not required to endanger his own life to save another, he should not be overly protective of his own safety. So there is the Choshen Mishpat. That's part of the Shulchan Aruch. It's one-fourth of the Shulchan Aruch, the code of law that was created in the 16th century by Rabbi Yosef Karo. And in that compendium, you have to even somewhat endanger your own life, if you will. You can't be too careful about your own. You've got to take care of it. He doesn't say, per se, that it's in the case of the murderer chasing the one who's about to be killed. But it sounds like, with the word, his blood is being shed, that they go with maybe the first thought of our Gemara, right after the Mishnah, which thought that this verse was actually proving the case of the one chasing after his friend can be protected by taking the life of the pursuer. Turn the page. This is, Rabbi Lippmann is written on the top left-hand corner. This is a case where Rabbi Dov Lippmann, recently elected to the Knesset in Israel, who grew up here in New York, American Ole, who's now in the Knesset as a minister. MK. What?
Member.
Yeah, member of Knesset. He says, when the tensions in Beit Shemesh happened, which has become the flashpoint for the battle of ideology between secular and some religious Jews, particularly on the issue of female segregation, reached a boiling point this week when it was revealed that a group of so-called Haredi men attacked a community rav attempting to escort girls to school. Rabbi Dov Lipman is a resident of Beit Shemesh and a community activist. Even before media reports surfaced of an 8-year-old girl in Beit Shemesh being spat on for wearing clothing that was not deemed modest enough, however, he had spoken out. The girl, Nama Margulies, said she was being regularly assaulted as she attempted to enter a religious Zionist elementary school, or Rot, located on the border of the city's ultra-Orthodox neighborhood. Other female students also reported harassment and assault, and Rabbi Lipman, who immigrated to Israel from the U.S. 7 years ago and who teaches at religious schools, had gone to the school to assist the students. On December 12th, he found himself the target of vicious physical assault. One morning I saw that they, fanatics, were not allowing schoolgirls to make their way to the school grounds, Lipman said. The gang recognized me and began yelling my name in the most threatening way. I was terrified. They yelled, "Don't defile our neighborhood," at the top of their lungs. Once I ran to help one of the schoolgirls who was crying, and they spat in my face, surrounding me and calling me Satan and Amalek. In another incident, the rabbi recalled how a group of fanatics shouted, "Lipman must be cut into pieces." And when he was here and he spoke at the 92nd Street Y, he talked about how he and his family are currently still under the protection of the police for death threats that he's received. "The police asked me to bring a camera to record the attackers. I did so and filmed a fanatic man picking up a stone while threatening a woman," Lipman said. "After I filmed it with a friend, the fanatics jumped me and began pulling at me. I was dragged along on the floor while the gang kicked my friend in the stomach. Never in my life have I seen such a thing." Despite the violence, Lipman remains determined to work toward eradicating fanaticism. "We must take a stand against these thugs despite our fear. I am against anyone who would dictate the lives of others." He's a Haredi man. He's an ultra-religious man himself, Dov Lipman. He stood. True.
Israel. They should be not Jewish.
So Rabbi Lipman describes them as being those who would dictate the lives of others, and therefore is trying to legislate in Israel further law within the system. Speaks calmly, doesn't let his emotions take over, argues that no one can, A, use this tradition to spit in anybody's face, B, that they should be punished through the systems of laws and courts and dragged to the Beit HaMishpat, C, that they're entitled to their opinions and perhaps even to schools that would allow for modest neighborhoods to thrive and not have anyone have to walk through them, and he's into creating such spaces. D, but no one can say about any other school that they're sinners, and he would even say that certain speech that has within it the parlance of Talmudic diction, let's say, Talmudic phrasing, used in this wrong way, would be hate speech. First time that someone's willing to come out and say that certain words can be criminalized, even if there's a logical basis behind using them, according to their thinking. Now, it's a very, very deep, it's a consideration that goes to the very core and heart of Talmudic logic and argumentation. Kind of says, are you willing to really limit the Beit Midrash, the speech of the Talmudic argumentation?
But can I ask a question? Because I have a, besides my own personal problem with hate speech, I have a real problem with that. I think it's very dangerous. But my question is, if it's these Haredis' interest to protect the modesty of a woman, how could spitting on someone to punish her for her crime not be as bad or worse than the thing that they're blaming?
Well, he's saying it is.
Well, I realize, but I'm trying to figure out what they think.
I, I, I,
can't.
I'm saying, so I just want to discourage the
people
logic to people who don't know.
But fear.
They're Israel. They're not Jewish. They hate women. They should be excommunicated.
I would give them with Jerusalem to the Jordanian and keep them in Jordan.
I know that this is going to spark some emotional reaction, and I wanted to show you that he wrote in the title of the piece, "I won't stand idly by." He has taken this verse, our verse, "I won't stand idly by." I won't stand idly by the blood of my.
2011.
What's happened?
Anything changed since?
So, of course, they were arrested. They had footage. They had videotape. They were prosecuted under the law.
They will do it again.
Well, you can't stop. You can't stop people. That's not the point. My point is not to hear, figure out what the ends were of the case. My point here is to say that he felt compelled by Torah to stand up against this. And because he lives that way, remember we talked once about how verses of the Torah really create the action? He really lived that. He really speaks that language. This verse that was Talmudic at one point, and whether it was the source to go jump in the river to find somebody and save them from being drowned, he saved this young woman. He believes that he created Torah in the world by coming to escort her, and the kind of Torah. In that vein, I want to point out that the conservative movement also uses this verse to encourage us to live Torah in a very different way, but in its own way, hopefully to the point of righteousness. I just want to show you what was included in the Eitz Chaim Chumash, which was published by the Rabbinical Assembly in the United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism. If you turn to the next page, you see that it's the same verse I included. It's verse 16, Lo Telech Achil Ba'amecha, don't deal debasely with your countrymen. Don't go out and gossip. Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. Do not profit by the blood of your fellow, is how it's translated. Do not profit by the blood of your fellow. I don't really understand the word profit.
Don't do nothing.
In other words, don't do nothing is at the core of it, but I don't understand the choice of the word profit, but that's for a different matter.
Insider trading.
Yeah, I mean...
But that's hard to draw from ta'amod.
It's hard to draw, but you're right. I mean, like, let's say insider trading as an example. So I should blow the whistle, right? What does our group of Rabbanim in our age do with this verse? Don't stand idly by the blood of your brother. They get to a hyper, on one hand, hyper peshat, a very, very, deep reading of the simplest sense of the text, which is advanced in a scientific way because of our age. They use this, don't stand idly by the blood of your brother. I once said this in Beit Knesset downstairs, that we live in an age where more and more truth of Torah is really happening, in the sense that, when was the first blood transfusion? And how do we know that you can't stand idly by the blood of your brother? The conservative movement has a halachic responsum, a Jewish legal document that says it is now an obligation, if possible, recognizing that for some it's not possible for many reasons, to give blood at blood banks, and on top of that, to arrange to have one's organs donated for transplant after death. A positive obligation, according to Rabbi Avi Reisman, and accepted by the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards. From this verse, hanging their hats on this verse to say that we can understand in today's world that actually standing idly by the blood of your brother can be understood not only metaphorically, not just in the case of the Rodesh, the one chasing after his friend to murder him, not in the case of only the river and the guy drowning, the leaf seam, the bandits. Not in only the case of the beasts, but that you can, by affixing the organ donor sticker to your license, to your state ID, ultimately fulfill the words of this verse of Torah.
Did the Orthodox propose that?
So it's a very interesting debate. So you have various great, great minds in the Orthodox world.
Israel is very advanced in this, and last April 1st there was a law in Israel that, and I said it, I told the story last semester on that issue here, that in Israel it used to be that 5,000 people a month used to be registered to give as a donor. But the Orthodox never did it, so they changed the law and says, if you are not on the list and you are equal in being a receptor, a receiver of it, you are not going to get it, but the one that is a donor. The same, the April 1st, 70,000 people registered.
Yeah. I mean, so
that's the ratio. And Israel is the first in the world to do this kind of experiment.
This
is the law of the land.
So I ultimately was going
to
say.
Because the Orthodox didn't want to participate in it at all.
Right.
Completely wanted to be out. They're still out, I see.
So that whether the authority of the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards actually takes hold in one's own personal life in America, that's debatable. That's up to us, each of us individually, right? We could see a good argument on behalf of the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards. We could study that tshuva together. Maybe we should at some point really have a discussion about this tshuva about organ donation, the tshuva about what it means to make health proxies if people don't have health proxies, and that it's a positive commandment to be able to tell your wishes in today's world where there's all these halachic matters that might come up with feeding tubes to life-saving machinery. Okay, different story for a different time. But here we go with a verse, and they include it right in the Chumash. And their idea in this, in terms of the printing of this Chumash, was to put this in the seats. So it's right in front of you. You know, when you get to that verse, each of the Shabbatot that you're going to come around to that Torah portion, and you're going to be sitting in shul. And I think it's an interesting inclusion. It's not a, so just let me finish the point, it's not foreign to us to actually have halakha, Jewish law, within traditional commentaries. And for instance, this copy of the Chumash, this one is it's a smaller version of one that also comes in larger size, it has within it what's called Likutei Birrei HaMitzvot Me'arambam. It's the wellsprings, it's the book of mitzvot of the Rambam, of Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon. And it lists out the mitzvot. And when it comes to the mitzvah of Lo Ta'amod Al Dam Re'echa, don't stand idly by the blood of your brother, it says, Kol HaYachol HaTzil V'lo Yitzil, anybody who was able to save somebody and didn't save somebody, Over Al Lo Ta'amod Al Dam Re'echa, commits the sin of standing idly by the blood of his brother.
Is somebody Jew or non-Jew or only Jew?
Okay, so the Rambam, if we want to be honest about what he's writing, there are two manuscripts. There's manuscript traditions. One for sure is that he has all kinds of texts about how it's only Jewish souls. And that was brought forward in many, many texts. So, in many different places within the text. So we know that there's an attitude. What is that attitude really all about, according to further commentaries, though? That attitude regards non-Jews who were looking always to commit great atrocities and genocide even against the Jewish people. But when it came to actually applying that kind of thinking to communities that we could coexist with, in ways that would not be threatening to us as a people, even, according to some of the sources, even the Rambam's look at those others would be very different than his description of the non-Jew who shouldn't be saved and even, quote-unquote, killed. But it's a question that stands, because we do know that the Rambam, in fact, had such attitudinal texts that exist when it comes to who you save and who you do not. Mishnah 2. We saw this in the Gemara. just seconds ago about, you know, kind of who you trust and who you don't, and the sage of Israel who's coming, you're never going to kill him because he wouldn't, of course, kill you. But we're only talking about within the context of community versus not the context of the non-Jewish community. These matters have to be looked at. Here, when it comes to this text, point is made, again, in the conservative world, if you give blood to a blood bank, can you at all say only for Jews? Absolutely not. I believe in Israel, part of the reality of the blood banks as well is that they go to hospitals that serve all members of the Israeli population, that you cannot say it's only for Jews that I want to donate my blood, and that was part of the issue for some of the people in the past. And now, with progressive law that commands people to do it in Israel, can you imagine if in America we took from the quote-unquote, what some people like to say, again, different topic for a different day, Judeo-Christian tradition? Imagine if the Judeo tradition of where the conservative movement is on this issue, that you're actually obligated to donate blood if you can, and what Israel's current law that Ron told us about supports the move in this country to really put us on the registries for donating when we can. So it's an interesting modern application of these texts. You want to say something before I just...
Oh, it was just the concept of Rodef that was interesting to me, because you have Rodef meaning another human being, but you could have the river is also a Rodef looking to steal somebody, and disease is also a Rodef. Just not human form of a Rodef.
Huh, and you're obligated then.
Right.
To put a guarding wall on this river, or research the disease.
Right.
I like
or
the application.
Donate blood.
Yeah, nice.
It's a very big push towards applying this in very much the broad sense, metaphorically, of the different ways it could be.
I just wanted to add that it's not only the RA that has gone forward in this regard, it's also in the modern Orthodox movement. I don't know if it was 6 or 7 years ago, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg's son was killed in Israel on a bicycle, and the family, Yitz and Blue Greenberg, made a big deal about donating his organs,
mm-hmm.
and they're modern Orthodox.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not only, you know, there are other progressive strains. In
yeah, with
JJ.
With Love Shalom. With this issue, there's definitely discussion about permissibility with organ transplant and people relying on some type of understanding of when death actually occurs in terms of the breath versus the brain, and trying to really figure out this moment of actual bodily death and with those who are able to do the harvesting, you know, to try to work out with communities to actually do it at a time that's permissible. There's a lot of work going on this. So I wanted to just show you where this verse went. The other piece that it goes back to, though, is the original spot where the verse is found. If you just turn the page to chapter 7 of the Rambam in the Mishneh Torah. Yeah, I'm skipping. Chapter 1 is the end. Chapter 7 is just before the end. Chapter 7 says, a person who collects gossip about a colleague violates a prohibition. Do not go around gossiping among your people. Right? So even though this transgression is not punished by lashes, it is a severe sin and can cause the death of many Jews. Therefore, the warning, do not stand still over your neighbor's blood, is placed next to it in the Torah. So what does he link it to over here, the Rambam? He links it to the fact that if you will be a gossiper and a talebearer, you will, in essence, be a potential blood spiller.
Mm-hmm.
And not standing idly by, meaning keep your mouth shut when you need to keep your mouth shut. So, interesting outgrowth of our Gemara discussion.
Thank you.
Erev Tov, Laila Tov.
Thank you.
Right. I got these made into this specific red that I...